Take the bass line out. Uh-huh.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Hardwood Knock Podcast. I am Dan Favalli, coming at you, as always, with my super-duper, incredibly awesome, esteemed co-host, Andy Bailey. We are super, incredibly pleased tonight to be joined by Associate Editor of Salt City Hoops, Dan Clayton. He is kind enough to jump on and talk to us about quarter poll report card grades for every Western Conference team in the NBA right now. Before we get started, though, really quick, I just want to remind everybody to subscribe, rate, and review us on iTunes. We really appreciate any rating, subscriptions, and feedback that we can get. As always, we love each and every listener, even the ones who hate listen to us. So please make sure you're going to go ahead and do that. And also, you can follow us at Hardwood Knox on Twitter. So, Dan, how are you doing tonight?
Doing great. Nice to get a double dose of Dan on the podcast, I guess. And I'm just surprised that you get. I thought that's all people did with podcasts was hate listen. So that's encouraging to hear that some people might listen to this but like it. So cool.
We get hate listeners who hate numbers, which is very weird when it's an NBA math sponsored podcast who hate to be surprised that there are numbers on it. So those are the fun hate listeners.
All right, you got to keep the numbers out of basketball.
I'm going to throw it to you, though, to start us off because you are the guest. Which team would you like to start off with for report card grades tonight?
Well, I mean, who's more interesting in the West than Oklahoma City, right? I mean, they're the team I struggled with a lot when making the grade, because I think anytime you do the grades exercise, you have to decide, am I grading on an absolute basis or relative to expectations? And, you know, we talked a little bit about that in prep, but I think my grade for OKC is less of a true grade and more of a metaphor of sorts, because I think OKC is that super talented high school kid who, you know, national merit scholar, great SATs, ACTs, and then screws around for the first few weeks of the semester, realizes he's tracking to a C minus, realizes that that's not going to be good enough to get into the schools he wants, and now he's got to do, you know, a bunch of extra credit to catch up to the grades he needs to accomplish his goals. And that's sort of what OKC feels like. I mean, they want to be a top four seed, and right now they're not even in the playoff picture. And granted, you know, we're talking about their record after 22 games, so there's a lot of time to think about playoff seeding. But as of right now, going into tonight's bout with the Jazz, they are number nine in the Western Conference playoff seeds. So, and they haven't even played a particularly tough schedule. They have played, you know, their strength of schedule right now is just under zero, meaning it's slightly easier than the average schedule. So, you know, they are going to have to, in order to make up some of the games that they've coughed away with their 10-12 record, they're going to have to now go and do extra credit, like my metaphor. You know, they're going to have to go beat some good teams, and certainly they can do it. But I think what's confusing about OKC and why I think C minus is a pretty fair grade relative to expectations is the fact that they're kind of the anti-Minnesota in that everybody assumed that they'd be able to find ways to score, but, you know, could they piece together enough defense to make it happen? They're number three in defensive rating after I'm sorry, by the way, hate listeners. That's kind of a metric. That's a number. But but anyway, you know, they're defending all right. Right now there's just obviously some weirdness as the three big stars try to fit together with all the other complementary pieces. So to me, they're a confusing team, but to call them anything higher than a C minus team after 22 games just would be generous. So that's where I pegged them, both metaphorically and as a measure of performance. I don't know what you guys think of the Thunder.
I've got them at a D plus. So pretty close.
Is that even
close.
A grade? I've never even heard of a D plus. I love it. I'm just curious. Can you get a D plus? I thought it was just straight D's.
Well, the Thunder just did.
I think you can get a D plus. You just can't get like an F plus. But a D plus would be like the ultimate passive aggressive teacher, right? Like you're getting a D, plus.
It is the Paul George standing stationary above the break of teacher grades.
There you go. Yeah, so it's pretty much in line with where you are, just a half letter grade down or from your C minus. I was tempted to fail the Thunder. But like you said, their defense it's number three right now. They actually have a positive net rating, which is still crazy. They're outscoring opponents by 2.3 points per 100 possessions. But when you have the reigning MVP, you get Paul George, who I think by almost all accounts, I mean, just about everybody would consider him a top 20 player last year. I would say the sports world was maybe torn on the Carmelo edition, but he's more name value at the very least. And the returns that they got, they didn't have to ship much out, at least based on like the reaction this summer to those trades. I mean, everybody panned the Pacers when that deal was made. They were expected to have this great big three, one of the best in the league. And like Dan said, they're 10-12. And ultimately, obviously, that matters more than your net rating. And one of my favorite stats for them remains, and I just lost it, they are minus 35.6 points per 100 possessions in clutch situations. So in the last 5 minutes of a game, when the score is within 5 points, they're just getting destroyed. So, yeah, there are some silver linings. The defense is good. You still think after a quarter of the season, there's plenty of time for them to turn it on and start working on those extra credit assignments like Dan talked about. But to this point, this just feels like a massive underachievement to me.
I gave them a C-. I was with Dan, so, and we're right around where Andy was too, so no one's too far off. And to kind of step on the heels of what you were saying about their clutch time performance, they're 3-3 when they don't trail entering clutch time. So when it's tied or they're ahead by, so that's like, that's not good. You can't be a coin toss if you're a good team when you're tied or in the lead. So that was kind of mind blowing to me too. And over the past few games, they've done a little bit better on the offensive end, looking at Carmelo Anthony assuming a bit of a lower usage role, but how long is that going to persist? Andre Roberson's been able to do more than kind of just bricklay threes. They seem to be getting him going on cuts a little bit more, but they just seem so imbalanced on the offensive end. And I was high on the Thunder entering this season, but I'm starting to wonder whether there's any path toward an adequate give and take relationship between Westbrook, George, and Anthony. The three of them so far have used more isolation possessions than 27 of the NBA's 29 other teams, just between the three of them. So, and no team obviously goes to isolations more than the Thunder at this point. It's just a very awkward situation, and I'm almost surprised that their defense is so good, but they have some nice switchable players, and Paul George has been fantastic at that end of the floor. But looking at how bad they've been in crunch time, you have your best players are shooting a combined under 32% down the stretch, under 23% from three. I think if you're moving, let's say, to January 1st, and you're kind of still in this weird limbo where maybe, yes, you're above 500, but you're not top four or top three in the West, that's when you have to really start look at, to me, moving Paul George rather than losing him in free agency for nothing. Maybe you could still bait Cleveland into giving up that Nets pick, depending on where they are and how serious they are about beating the Warriors this season or how confident they are about keeping LeBron James. So I've been disappointed that it's taken the Thunder this long to figure out things on the offensive end. And even when they've been better, they haven't been great. And if the solution, like it has been maybe over the last two or three games, is Carmelo Anthony taking 10 or less shots, that's just not going to last.
Yeah, figuring out the shot distribution has definitely been weird for them all season, and something they're probably going to have to continue to work on throughout the year. I feel like we're going to have to move fairly rapid fire through these, so I am just going to usurp Dan's authority and pick the next Rude. Team we're going to do. I am going to stay in the same general region of the country and go with the San Antonio Spurs, who I am giving an A because Kawhi Leonard has yet to play a single second this season. The Spurs are still on pace for, I think last time I checked, mid-50s to high-50s in wins. LaMarcus Aldridge is having the best season of his entire career, now well into his 30s. Rudy Gay is like a completely different player this season. Kyle Anderson is finally starting to show some of the promise that we thought he might have coming out of UCLA, although he's recently suffered an MCL strain. But there's just so many things to like about the way that the Spurs are playing right now. And it's, you know, everybody makes this joke, but it really is just sort of like death taxes in the Spurs. They are never going away. So I'm giving them an A. What say you, Dan Clayton?
I would say an A is generous. I went B plus on the Spurs, and here's my logic. Yes, they still have yet to debut Kawhi, and he's an MVP candidate, and obviously things are going to change once they get him back. So before Spurs fans freak out, and panic, like obviously that's going to change the trajectory. And yes, they've revived LaMarcus Aldridge in a way that is interesting, and obviously people around the NBA scratched their heads when they extended LaMarcus Aldridge based on kind of all the questions about fit and those sorts of things. So, hey, I think they deserve credit for A, having faith in LaMarcus after all of that, and then obviously seeing some of that faith come to fruition with such a great year. I guess the problem was they've just lost so many games that I feel like a team as good as the Spurs probably shouldn't lose if they're trying to stay in Golden State and Houston's zip code. And the result is that they're not in Golden State and Houston's zip code. I mean, there's a huge chasm between where the Warriors and the Rockets are and where San Antonio is. And I think that that's the result of, you know, a four-game losing streak going into the start of November, or losing at home to Milwaukee, or losing at Minnesota, at New Orleans. They lost at OKC just the other night in a close one. So, you know, those are losses that in a vacuum you can certainly understand. And some of those games came with big opponent performances. I just feel like to be an A team or even an A-minus team at this point in the season, you have to be doing a little bit. I mean, they're tracking to basically a 50 win season. That's where their projections are headed. If you look at some of the different systems out there, like 538 and SRS and BPI, and like, look, there's nothing wrong with a 50 win season. A lot of NBA teams would like seriously give an arm to have their teams win 50 games this season. But I just don't know that 50 is necessarily where we put the bar for a team like San Antonio, whether or not that's fair, given, again, the fact that they have an MVP candidate who hasn't put on sneakers yet.
Yeah, that's why it's tough for me not to give them an A. They're basically playing like a top seven team this year without a top five player. And since Tony Parker's come back, that offensive combination between him and LaMarcus Aldridge has been absolutely lethal. The Spurs' offense has not been good overall this season, but they're scoring like a top eight offense when LaMarcus Aldridge is on the floor. And last year, when you look at the numbers, they scored like a top two offense whenever Kawhi Leonard played. So kind of once you get him back, I would think that they're going to blow by those early 50 projections. Like, it seems like as of now, they're on pace to win 55 games, and I would be surprised if they don't reach that benchmark or surpass it when you have to figure that Kawhi Leonard's coming back. The defense has been great. Andy pointed out what Kyle Anderson was doing before he got injured. I don't know who thought that Rudy Gay might actually opt out of his contract next season entering this year, but he's playing so well that he actually might. And it's going to be really interesting to see how they run out these combinations with Green, Leonard, and Gay on the floor at the same time and what they can do defensively when they're switching. That, of course, is me projecting, but I just don't – a team is on pace without a top five player to win 54, 55 games right now, and that just – that kind of just boggles my mind, even for the Spurs. And we talk about some of their losses. You know, they rolled out the C squad against the Thunder, and they erased a 14-point lead and almost came back and won, taking advantage of Oklahoma City's inability to close games at some point. That depth is just something that I can appreciate, and this is going to be – it feels like we're saying this every year now, but it looks like it's going to be one of Greg Popovich's better bodies of work as a head coach. So it's tough. I kind of get what Dan is saying, but it's tough for me not to give them an A when they've done all this without Kawhi Leonard.
I mean, I get all of that. And really, if you take away the OKC game where, to your point, they didn't play their best players. In fact, they left most of their guys at home. Aside from that game, they've won their most recent five. So, like, I get the tendency to just assume that everything is still humming in Spursville. I guess I would just say before that run, that 5-1 stretch where they only lost is the OKC game by the JV squad, they were 11-7. You know, give them credit for turning it on here since Thanksgiving. But, you know, they just kind of like have been bobbing along for October and most of November. And I guess that's mostly what I was referring to when I said that I felt like they've just kind of lost some games that I would have expected to see them win or at least perform better in.
And to your point,
I was going to say, if I'm the passive aggressive teacher, Dan is the one who gives out the 89.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. Actually, my dad was a teacher, and he was totally that guy. So it makes sense that I would inherit that.
Well, perfect. And to Dan's point, the Spurs have played one of the 5 easiest schedules in the NBA per Basketball Reference. So that's something to factor in as well. Moving on, a team that I find kind of fascinating is the New Orleans Pelicans, who I gave a B-. I've been very impressed with what they've been doing with their offense. They're running a lot of horn stuff for Anthony Davis and DeMarcus Cousins. It's working. Their point differential per 100 possessions with both on the floor has kind of fluctuated, but they've shown that they can kind of dominate stretches with them in the game. I'm really intrigued by their basically three guards and then Davis and DeMarcus Cousins lineup combinations. I think those have some sneaky potential on both ends of the floor. The one thing I've been a little disappointed in is that I think you can argue that both Davis and DeMarcus Cousins have been good to great on the defensive end, even when you factor in Boogie's vacillating effort levels. He's just been a really good rim protector thanks to what Davis is able to do everywhere else. It makes life easier on him. They're 20th in points allowed per 100 possessions, which just feels like a problem. There are a lot of injuries in the West, so that should kind of help them stay in the thick of the playoff picture, but I'm just waiting for them to dangle a future first round pick in a trade to kind of go after another wing who might be able to defend or who's going to be able to increase the gap between their offense, which currently ranks 8th in points scored per 100 possessions, and that shoddy defense, because it seems like they kind of need this midseason push to not only make the playoffs, I think they'll get there no matter what, but to turn DeMarcus Cousins' free agency into a non-issue. So where did you have this team at, Dan?
Yeah, I had them at a B- too, and everything. So I had them at a B- largely because I didn't necessarily believe in them going into the season. I knew that on paper they should be kind of in the playoff picture, but kind of wanted to see them prove it first. And now here they are in the thick of things, and they'll probably be in the 5-8 race all season long. I guess the thing with New Orleans is until this recent thing with Anthony Davis, which is literally like days old, it happened Friday night. You know, they were the healthiest team in this Western Conference scrum, or at least one of the healthiest teams in the scrum. You know, the players who have missed significant time for them are guys like, the rookie, Frank Jackson.
Oh, yeah.
Has still not. Yeah. You know, Solomon Hill, whatever, cool utility player, I guess, if you like a 3-and-D specialist who neither shoots threes particularly well or always defends great. You know what I mean? Like, they just, until AD hurt his groin the other night, everything was going right for them from a health standpoint, and yet they're still kind of just bobbing along in mediocre waters. So I also had them at a B-, and I honestly, I think that this is kind of where they're going to hover all year, right around the 500 mark. And when Boogie and AD are healthy, they're going to be stretches where they terrorize people, and they're also going to be stretches where they struggle.
So I think bobbing along in mediocre waters is a pretty good way to assess the Pelicans this season. I'm pretty close to you guys. I had them at a C+. I just feel like when you have two of, I would say, top 15 players in the NBA, there should be more games where you are just demonstrably better than the opposition. And most nights when I tune in to watch the Pelicans, or I kind of follow along on the box score, either way, very few of their games feel like a gimme win to me. So that's kind of why I'm a little bit harder on them than you are. The other thing is they've gotten so little help from the supporting cast around those two guys. Anthony Davis and DeMarcus Cousins They both have box plus minuses around 5, and every other player on the team is below 0. So there's just so little help for those two. And I would say that, I mean, it's just those two guys single-handedly getting them a passing grade from me, because everywhere, I mean, Drew Holiday has been a big disappointment to me this season. Rajon Rondo's been okay since he's come back, but I mean, he's has all the same deficiencies he's had for the last 4 or 5 years. So, you know, other guys who are playing big minutes, Tony Allen looks done. You can't even put guys like Omer Asik and on the floor. So I am giving them a passing grade just because those two are so good. But after that, it's pretty ugly.
Who do you think has been their this is to both of you. Who do you think has been their best supporting cast member this year? I think there's probably a case to be made for Darius Miller.
That's who I was going to say. I'll let Dan answer though too.
Yeah, I don't know. I was blanking because it's such a trick question. I mean, yeah, I guess quantitatively, just it has to be Drew. In like,
he said the biggest like individual. Yeah,
yeah.
He said the biggest individual games, I think.
And by the way, like, you know, Etwan Moore, when I saw that their plan was to have him start, I kind of chuckled. I've just never thought of him that, you know, he's been such a journeyman. Always a solid rotation player, by the way. I don't mean this to be an insult for Etwan Moore, but just to see him averaging double figures and doing it on decent efficiency, and he's making a bunch of threes, you know, he's shooting 4 threes a game and canning almost half of them. So, you know, I think he's impressive. But yeah, I mean, Darius Miller is certainly one of the more interesting surprises they've had. And the fact that he's the first name that comes up is just indicative of exactly what you were saying. It's a two-man team right now.
I would agree with that. I think we're back to you, Dan, as well on picking a team to grade.
Well, I don't know. Should we just get a boring one out of the way? Because, like, we have to talk about all 15, and, like, everyone knows that Golden State is going to be an A. So should we just hurry and give them the A and move on? I mean, Golden State is once again just doing historical things. You know, a net rating of close to 13. Their offense is, you know, historically good. They have an assist percentage of 70%. Just think about that. I mean, like, that's
crazy.
Just a machine. It's nuts. And watching them is just like an instructional video in team basketball all the time. Their true shooting percentage as a team is 62%, which is nuts. It's nuts. I mean, like, 62%, if a player had a 62% true shooting percentage, we'd be pretty impressed with that. So, Golden State is an A. They're an easy A. You know, they're doing nothing to indicate that they're bored or demotivated or anything else. And we can only hope that this Steph Curry stuff is a very short term deal. It sounds like he's doubtful for tomorrow night, but doubtful is pretty good news considering how bad it looked. So let's hope they get Steph back and we can keep seeing how good that team is.
I'll let you go next, Mr. Favelli.
Well, if we're here to get A's out of the way, people are not going to be happy about my grade. I gave them a B+, and I know they've dealt with some injuries. Kevin Durant's missed some games. The Stephen Curry thing, we know he's going to miss about at least 2 weeks or be reevaluated in 2 weeks. This is, I think, a period of time where we're going to realize that he is Golden State's most valuable player still, just for the holdouts who might believe it's Kevin Durant or even Draymond Green at this point. For me, I'm just... I kind of disagree with Dan in the sense that they've been in cruise control too much at, like, different points. Like, letting the Pelicans hang around the other night, they give up a lot more three-pointers on defense than they probably should. It's hard to really criticize them because they have the league's top offense, and you can't really – you'd like Andre Iguodala when he's healthy to shoot better from three. Even Draymond Green, he's once again below the league average. There's just something sleepwalky about their defense. They rank 7th in points allowed per 100 possessions, but I'm just not impressed with it yet. And I get that this is the part of the season where they know they're so great that they don't care about the smaller goals, and we know what they're trying to do, which is win another NBA title. I get that, but just evaluating them against what they have the potential to do and all this chatter that's just coming from Kevin Durant, getting in these scuffles, it seems like, every night. It was last night in the win over the Pelicans on Monday night, where he's getting mad at DeMarcus Cousins for who knows what. Maybe Cousins called him out for being listed at 6'9 when he's really like 7'5. But I don't know. Like, I've just been unimpressed with their defense, and Kerr's even called them out for their effort a bunch of times this year. So knowing what they're capable of, I have to go with a B plus.
So I actually gave them a B plus too, and it's just because it's all. I mean, these grades are kind of relative with me. When I look at what Golden State has done over the last 3 years, I just don't feel like they're quite playing up to the standard that they've set. The numbers that Dan listed off, like a team true shooting percentage of 62, is absolutely absurd. But I do feel like there's been more sort of mental and psychological lapses from them than usual. I think the ejection Dan cited from the Pelicans game, wasn't that Durant's third of the season?
Yeah, I believe so.
There's certainly something weird going on with him. And having said all this, like, this is the quarter mark grades of the season, and I am fully confident that the Warriors will become the, you know, 2016-17, 2015-16 Warriors at some point in the season and roll through the playoffs, assuming health. But just relative to what they've done in the past, I haven't felt like they're quite up to their typical level of play.
I mean, that's fair. They're 19-6. You know what
yeah,
I mean?
Which is, like, yeah, it's like that's like a – that being a disappointment.
If they're sleepwalking, yeah. If they're sleepwalking and they're 19-6 with a +13 net rating, almost. I get what you guys are saying. I think it's a little like, you know, we do with the Cavs and we do with some other teams where, you know, it's more fun to manufacture drama in December than not. I don't have any concerns about the Warriors. Let me just say that. I'll accept a B plus. I think you guys both lay out good cases. And certainly there are individual nights where it's hard to get up for playing the Sacramento Kings and they beat you by 4 because you've got some players missing. You know, that's even though they had some players out. I'm just saying if the worst thing we can say about them is that they've sleepwalked.
Would be the past tense? I would say sleepwalked.
What is it?
Anyway,
like, yeah, go ahead.
if they're sleepwalking 19-6, then I'm pretty comfortable they'll come out okay.
I just the ejections just feel superfluous, and it's I don't know. Some of this stuff just bothers, and the fact that Kerr has to call them out for it is just weird to me too. I agree. If you're gonna sleepwalk to 19-6, you're fantastic, but it just seems. Again, even I don't know. I just have not been impressed with relative to how we know they can perform. Just some of the extracurricular stuff just is kind of buggy.
They'll end up. I'm almost certain they'll end up with an A. They've got plenty of time to pull that grade up from me and Dan.
The ship is sinking, and they need to trade everybody.
I am going to move us on to the Denver Nuggets.
Ooh.
They are, so right now they have a negative net rating. They're being outscored by 0.3 points per 100 possessions. The defense is really bad again for the second year in a row. It's not really bad. It's 21st, so it's better than it was last season. I gave them a C+. And as it comes out of my mouth, I feel like I'm almost being too hard on them given the injuries.
You are.
When Millsap and Jokic are on the floor together, they've been really good. But I don't know. I expected more from this team, and it's probably not fair to fault them with all the injuries that they've had to deal with. They're still winning games behind, you know, guys like Will Barton, although they got beat by the Mavericks in their last tilt, which isn't good because the Mavericks were in a race to the bottom just a couple days ago. But they get a passing grade. I just thought they would be better this season. Anybody can jump in because I failed to throw it to anyone.
Our guest of honor, Dan Clayton, should go next for sure.
Well, yeah, I had them at a C, and you know, if you feel like you were harsh on them for a C+, now I get to feel like I was harsh on them for a C. But here's my issue with them. Even before the Paul Millsap injury, which is I think the one that is really going to damage their playoff hopes, Even before that, this team just – they looked even – I don't know if even worse is accurate, but they have looked so bad on defense relative to what I thought Paul Millsap's presence would do, a year of development for guys like Gary Harris would do, and Jamal Murray. They just – they really don't have that in their – in their DNA, in their identity. They've been above average on offense, and I think everybody expected that. But I just don't think that level of defensive performance, they're number 21 on defense, I don't think that's a recipe for playoff success. I think before the Paul Millsap injury, I had them as a team that was projecting that, I would have picked them as the top eight. And honestly, I think that injury moves them out. I think they will finish outside of the playoffs. And I think they're the one, I think they're the team in the top nine currently, or the, you know, the nine teams that we all sort of expect will be part of the conversation. They're the one that I have not making it. I just think 2 months without Paul Millsap, when they're already just struggling at a very basic, I mean, it's basic stuff. I'm pretty concerned about Denver. I think some of it is injury related, but some of it predates the injury.
I gave them a B-. So not too much better than you guys, but I guess I'm just kind of grading them on more of a curve because of the injuries. And Paul Millsap was just incredibly important to what they were doing defensively. They were okay for that long stretch. And then since he's been injured, they're 26th in points allowed per 100 possessions. And you can kind of make up that difference when you have just Nikola Jokic because of how good the offense stands to be. But now he's dealing with a sprained ankle. So I think once he comes back, things will start to settle. The big issue for them, though, that I will admit to, is they need to go out and trade for a wing or another veteran playmaker. Getting rid of Jameer Nelson is still one of the most puzzling moves.
What about Richard Jefferson, Dan?
That was literally stupid. It's just – and so Richard Jefferson isn't going to see the floor. And even – we're looking at there were injuries to Wilson Chandler, and like Malik Beasley just still can't get run. Like he's just struggling to be even an active player. I don't understand that. Like, is the alternative, oh, we're going to develop Juan Hernan Gomez as a three? I just don't – offensively fine, but defensively I just don't see it from him. And so that puzzles me. And Jameer Nelson was their most used point guard last season. I get that you were expecting – maybe quantum leaps from both Murray and Moutier, and you've kind of gotten it from an efficiency standpoint with Moutier, but neither of these guys are elite playmakers, so all of a sudden you're just tied to Nikola Jokic, like just so firmly, because you have these spot ball handlers around him like Gary Harris, like Will Barton, who's also been fantastic, but you don't have that one playmaker you can turn to, and maybe that's fine if you can lean on your defense, but you can't do that when Paul Millsap isn't on the floor, and he's not going to be for the next couple months. So I don't know whether it's can you go out and find a point guard that's going to be on the chopping block who helps you? Can you just pick up a role player wing? Maybe the Knicks are willing to trade Courtney Lee at this point, who's been fantastic as a shooter and defender, but they need to make a move because it's like Dan said, a lot of this does have to do with injuries, and I fully believe that even once Jokic comes back, they'll firmly be in the playoff picture. I would still pencil them in as a playoff team. I'm not worried about that, but they have some ingrained issues with the makeup of their roster that could have been avoided prior to the start of the season.
You mean it wasn't smart to have 17 power forwards and nobody that could defend the ball at the point? Because that's my problem with Moutier and Murray. I didn't expect either guy to suddenly become, you know, Russell Westbrook overnight, but I mean, both those guys are a big part of their defensive problem because just at the point of attack, neither one can really stay in front of the ball a lot of the times, and there are breakdowns on pretty simple pick and roll coverages. So I think that's really what's hurting them. Now I don't know that keeping Jameer Nelson would have made things that different for them defensively at point guard, but just to your point, you know, they put a lot of eggs in those two young point guard baskets, and I'm not sure that it's paying off for them right now.
Andy, do you think are you ready to like worry about their playoff stock?
I still have them in the playoffs. I think they're going to have to fight a little bit more than I anticipated before the season started. But I feel like they should have a pretty strong kick if Millsap and a closing kick if Millsap and Jokic are healthy down the stretch.
So I mean, I'm just curious then, not to hijack the, like, who do they? I don't know who out of these top nine finishes out.
I think I would say the two I'm most concerned about are the Pelicans and the Thunder. The Thunder are super talented, but there are just so many question marks about how these three guys fit together. Oh, and man, whether or not Russell Westbrook can really play with stars. It feels kind of like that season when everybody was certain that the Lakers would contend for a title with Kobe and Steve Nash and Dwight Howard, and they just did not mesh. Yeah. And we haven't heard about as many like personality clashes with this group as we did with that Lakers team. But just watching them play the like your turn, my turn ISO game that they do, it's definitely concerning for me.
Yeah,
if I had to pick one, I'd probably go Pelicans, but the Thunder concern me too.
See, I think the Thunder will make it. I think that they'll be a lower seed and it'll be a short spring for them. To me, it comes down to the Nuggets and the Pelicans, and just I don't know how the Nuggets paper over 2 months without Paul Millsap, and that's the explanation for my low grade.
Do we want to know who it comes down to for me? Because I don't think.
Yes, we do.
The Pelicans and the Timberwolves. I'm just not.
Interesting.
We'll get to Minnesota, but they have been like absolute crap on the defensive end. And their offense, I'm just convinced, and we'll have to talk about them, but they have one of the worst shot profiles in the league, and yet they somehow rank in the top, I think it was top five or top seven of points scored per 100 possessions. It's fifth right now. I just don't believe it's sustainable. I would trust the Nuggets a little bit more, especially because they have the maneuverability to make some trades as we get to that February trade deadline.
Maybe you should – I think it's your pick next. What if we just went with the Timberwolves?
I was going to go with the Grizzlies, but yeah, let's do the Timberwolves. So the Timberwolves, I don't know. I just have not been impressed with. It kind of seems like maybe they're finally possibly, if they're lucky and smart, starting to realize that Jimmy Butler is their best player. But I just don't know how they're – so this would be the stat, according to Cleaning the Glass in non-garbage time. Minnesota has 56.4% of its shots coming at the rim or from three-point range. That's the second lowest shot distribution in the league in front of only the Sacramento Kings. I know they're getting to the free throw line a bunch. They have the third highest free throw rate in the league, and Jimmy Butler has been particularly adept at getting to the line in crunch time. I just, how is that sustainable? And I know Jeff Teague is shooting okay, but the team still doesn't really shoot threes. Thibodeau has been, when they've been at full strength, which hasn't been much, he's been running out some of these all-bench units, a couple of which have actually been working, and I don't necessarily see that continuing either. I don't know what they do from here. We saw the report from Jerry Wofell of the Racine Journal Times that they were interested in DeAndre Jordan, which makes like zero sense because you have Taj Gibson and Karl Anthony Towns, and I don't think anyone – they've torpedoed Gorgui Dieng's trade stock, and I'm actually a fan of – Gorgui Dieng. I just don't know what this team is, and when their success is kind of propped up on getting to the free throw line and making shots that aren't necessarily high quality looks, I'm just not there. Taj Gibson's been better than expected. Jeff Teague has been fine, but they have no clear path toward defensive improvement, even if their offense kind of keeps things up right now, which again, I don't really think it will. And it's kind of impressive that they've played an above average schedule and are above 500 right now. I question whether this is going to last, especially with Karl Anthony Towns playing as bad on defense as he is. And you can see that it's impacting Gibson and more so Butler at points, having to play with Wiggins and Towns because it increases his responsibility just so much. So I ended up giving them a C. So I couldn't even get myself to bring them a B minus. So I have the Timberwolves at a C right now.
Dan?
I was about to say that's my fault. Throw it to DC.
Yeah, actually, I did give them a B minus just because I think there's something to be said for finding a way to be 14-11 when things weren't clicking with Jimmy Butler early on. They did find ways to win, but having said that, I agree with everything you said about macro trends. They're 4-6 over the last 10, so we can't even sit here and say, oh, they're finally figuring it out. You know, they're putting the pieces together. And, you know, they too, they just have a lot of bad losses. And even in a lot of their wins, I watched a bunch of their recent wins, because my brother-in-law was in town for the holidays and we, you know, might've had a friendly wager or two involving the Timberwolves, and we'd be watching the ends of close games. And I just remember saying a couple different times, man, they're just really good at playing really bad basketball. And it's just what you said, like, just bad possessions, the types of plays that you watch thinking, no. Okay, all right, that shot went. So it's fine. You know, they're a weird team for that reason. Ultimately, I went B minus, and it's just because on the macro, you know, they're still projecting out to about a 47-48 win season, which is what their Vegas line was. I think they're basically in line to meet expectations, but it's the how they're doing that and, you know, and the what they are that I couldn't go higher than B minus. So again, similar thinking, whether or not the grade was exactly lined up.
So I just, this just came to me while you guys were talking, and I think I'm going to tweet it when we're done recording to annoy some people.
Oh, good.
The thought came to my head. Andrew Wiggins is closer to a Ricky Davis type player than Scottie Pippen, which is kind of what he was profiled as this, you know, superstar in the, what was it, the 2014 draft. So I actually did the player comparison finder on Basketball Reference, and the PER, box plus minus, win shares per 48, all that with Ricky Davis and Andrew Wiggins, it's all very close. Because I look at Andrew Wiggins, he's just more of like a lazy defender chucker type player than I think anybody could have imagined when he was coming out of Kansas. The other, so just to get it out of the way, I'm giving them a C. The other reason I'm down on them, in addition to what I just said about Andrew Wiggins, Karl-Anthony Towns, the defense that everybody talks about with him, that's a very real concern. He just cannot cover pick and rolls. Tom Thibodeau, who has just for years been hailed as like the great defensive mastermind of the league, for a team with this much talent, and especially defensive talent, with a guy like Jimmy Butler, Taj Gibson's been a good defender for most of his career. For them to be 25th at this point is pretty disappointing. Not figuring out the way the shot distribution should be. I mean, that it took them this long, I think it was Dan Favalli who alluded to the fact that they're just now figuring out that Jimmy Butler's their best player. And maybe that's just because Butler himself was a little bit too passive in the early going. But for it to take that long to figure out that that's the go-to guy, that's a red flag to me too. I just feel like there's a bunch of issues here, but that they weren't one of the two teams that I said might miss the playoffs earlier, just because I think this is a team that they have so much talent. Karl-Anthony Towns, defensive issues aside, is amazing. Jimmy Butler, I think, was a top 10 player last year, so I still think there's plenty of time for them to figure it out, but just to this point, I got to go with a C.
You know what's the most Andrew Wiggins thing ever? And I think even I, and I'm sure a lot of people, kind of overestimated how uncomfortable he is playing without the ball. He's shooting 35.7% on pull-up threes this year and 30.4% on catch-and-shoot threes. And catch-and-shoot threes are supposed to be inherently easier. The quality of those looks are up for debate, obviously, but he's shooting 25.4% on wide-open three-pointers. Like, that's just... that's atrocious. And the last point I want to make is, because Andy talked about Tom Thibodeau, is he kind of like the next Doc Rivers, where his legacy is almost going to be debunked by what's kind of happening from hereafter? He seemed to coach some maniacal players in Chicago. Joakim Noah in his prime just wouldn't let the Bulls lose. Luol Deng, they had a bunch of scrappy guys, and the average pace was probably slower then, so it made it easier to cobble together a really good half-court defense. But I'm just wondering, have we overrated Thibodeau as a coach, or is this just a matter of he shouldn't have been given so much power over, say, on the roster? Because if things had gone differently over the offseason, you know, for what they paid Taj Gibson, maybe they could have gotten, I don't know, like PJ Tucker and Patrick Patterson, or Patrick Patterson and Luke and Bob Moot, who I was shocked went to the Rockets at the minimum. There's other stuff that goes on there. You know, PJ Tucker was buddy-buddy with Chris Paul and Trevor Ariza, I think, so he was always going to the Rockets. But just to give – Taj Gibson's been good, but to give 2 years and $8 million, I think it was, when you already had Jang and Towns, it just feels like a misuse of resources, and maybe you didn't properly build this roster. I just don't – I'm not – I'm kind of – Tom Thibodeau is just losing his mystique to me.
Yeah, and Teague over George Hill was interesting to me too. And I'll let Dan go ahead and make his point.
Well, I was just going to say, like, and who was on the phone offering 2 years and $27 million to Taj Gibson? You know what I mean? Who were you negotiating against there?
Yeah.
And Taj Gibson is a valuable player. I don't know that he starts on a lot of NBA teams. I think he starts on, I don't know, half-ish of NBA teams. But, you know, I'm with you. I thought that one was curious. And yeah, they just, I don't think we know what they are yet. And that's what's confusing. And yet still they're 14-11. And I'm with Andy. I think they're a playoff team still. But a lot of big fundamental questions for Minnesota still.
Taj Gibson shooting 86.5% inside 3 feet seems totally sustainable to me. I don't know about you guys.
I did not realize that. Yeah. He's been really good.
He's been good. I just don't – if he's – I don't know. I don't think that his offensive value is necessarily sustainable. Maybe he'll be good for them defensively all the time, but he's – him and Jimmy Butler clearly aren't going to offset Towns' just complete unawareness and Andrew Wiggins' just lackadaisical sets. I go back and forth on who I think is the Timberwolves' worst defender now, like, but just – or worse out of those – too. It was very clearly Wiggins last year, but Towns is making a good case for himself now.
A fun little side bet between those two. I think we're back to Dan Clayton for the next team.
Well, let's go. You know, we've mostly been talking about playoff teams or playoff-ish teams. I guess let me share the one team I failed. Oh, no, wait. One of two teams I failed.
Ooh, I'm ready.
I'm excited.
Yeah, I don't think, and again, record-wise, like if we were doing this pure record-wise, they'd get a better grade and whatever. But against expectations and just against how we're used to things running in the state of Tennessee where NBA basketball is concerned, I just don't think the Grizzlies could have had a worse early 2 months. You know, some of it's the Mike Conley injury, but like Memphis is not a place where you expect for there to be a coup d'etat. You know, 20 games into the season or whatever that was, you know, and Fizdale's firing, which like, say what you will. I know that our tendency on coach firings, because like the tendency of teams to just fire a coach when things get bad is ridiculous. And because of that tendency, our tendency is to assume that most coach firings are bogus and unfounded. But like, it came out that Fizdale had just not been communicating with Marc Gasol. And I don't know in the modern NBA,
terrible,
if there's a more important bullet point in the job description than, you know, communicate with your team's best player, communicate with your superstar. And if you're not doing that part of your job description well, it doesn't matter how well you're doing the rest. Like, you can't set a culture. You can't create a defensive system, an offensive mindset. You can't do any of those things if you don't have your best player on board. And, you know, to find out, I think we've all heard kind of the mumblings here and there that there are, you know, Memphis's front office is one of those where there are some different schools of thought and there's analytics minded people and some old school people. And like, we've heard that for a long time and that's fine. But to get into a season and realize that a player who is historically just a good citizen, doesn't really rub anybody the wrong way, good locker room guy in Marc Gasol, is, you know, so dissatisfied that he goes off on his coach for 10 minutes, his coach gets fired, and then, you know, they're still in the middle of just a terrible stretch of basketball. I should have checked this. I think they've lost 9 of their last 10.
Oh, they just even
broke
worse
a long streak.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Okay.
Like
yeah, so they...
3 of their last 15 they've won or something. It's something like that.
They lost 11 in a row. They went from 7-4 to 7-15 before they finally snapped it against Minnesota the other night.
And they celebrated like they won the title the other night. It was great.
Hey, I mean, when you can throw a parade, you throw a parade, right? So, you know, they're not as bad as a team that will get an F at the end of the season. Like, but in terms of just everything going wrong in the first 20 games, for a franchise that for a long time has been the, you know, one of those, oh, we do things the right way, we work hard, we, you know, we got classy guys and good citizens, and then, you know, to have the mayhem that they've dealt with, not just on an injury front, but on a personnel front and a coaching front and an everything front, it's just, it'd be a pretty discouraging time to be following the Memphis Grizzlies.
So I may not have factored in the front office chaos as much as I should have after listening to Dan's explanation for the F. I gave him a C minus just because before the season started, if somebody would have asked me to predict their record a quarter of the way into the season, it wouldn't have been too far off from this. I was very down on Memphis's roster before the season started. And then Dan and I recorded a podcast like a week or two into the season that was like, which of these big surprise hot starts is sustainable? And we were all on the Grizzlies bandwagon then. And I've jumped on and off like three times is what I'm trying to say. but at this point, they just kind of look like what I expected. I figured they would deal with injury issues just because a lot of their big name guys have had injuries a lot over the last few seasons. I didn't know specifically who it'd be. I just figured it would strike them at some point. Their bench has, even after the 11 game losing streak, there's still some pretty encouraging numbers about their bench. Tyreke Evans is having the best season of his career. So that's a positive you can point to. So overall, I just felt like they were about where I expected them to be, maybe a little bit worse. And that's why I went with the C-.
I actually failed them. And it was in large part because, as Dan was saying, the front office is incompetency. But it's kind of also for different reasons, because I get communicating with star players is important, but Mike Conley gave David Fizdale glowing reviews upon departure. And Gasol is in his age 33 season. He's not the star you side with, and he hasn't been particularly great this year either. Do we put that on Fizdale? Was he just not necessarily trying as hard? When Fizdale was fired, his most used lineup was Mike Conley, James Ennis, Marc Gasol, Andrew Harrison, and Jarrell Martin. There were times where Jarrell Martin had a play with Gasol and Brandon Wright because the Grizzlies just didn't have the personnel. He was constantly forced to tweak these different starting lineups. You lost so many players. Conley's out dealing with Achilles soreness, and that started before he was fired. Benching Gasol against the Nets probably isn't the best look, but it shouldn't be catty to send a message to your star player when he's not necessarily playing well, particularly when their bench has been so good. And as Andy's talking about their bench still having good numbers, Tyreke Evans has been starting, so he's not even necessarily included in those projections. This team looks like it's deeper than advertised, and had they been at full strength and gotten a real fair shake at it, I think they still could have been maybe not a playoff lock anymore because they had to go through this stretch, but they certainly could have rebounded from what's happened. And I thought getting rid of him was a little premature. It clearly had the makings of, even if Gasol didn't ask for it, we're picking the aging star player over the coach. And while I can kind of get that, it just seems like Fizdale was given this just unfair go at it this season. And from what we saw from the bench and how Tyreke Evans was playing and the emergence of Dylan Brooks, and just looking at the Grizzlies' shot profile under him, they were getting a lot of looks at the rim and beyond the three-point line combined. They just weren't hitting them, probably because of talent deficiencies. And if you look at what their shot distribution has been now since he left, it's slowly deteriorated. And I just, as a front office, I think you kind of maybe need to recognize when to tell the star player, like, shut the hell up, and, like, you need to just do what the coach is saying, because Marc Gasol's a great player, but I think Fizdale's a really good coach, and had you given him this healthy roster at something resembling full strength, the Grizzlies, in my opinion, would have been better. And even if they wouldn't, like, the way the front office handled this, you had to know there was tension before the beginning of the year. You should really do a better job of addressing that over the offseason. So they get a D for me, and I contemplated giving them an F.
Yeah, I mean, everything, like, again, for me, I failed them because of chaos writ large. It's, you know, you could argue a bunch of different outcomes to the Fizdale Gasol situation. You pointed to, you know, which star do you side with? The fact that the Memphis Grizzlies with Mike Conley and Marc Gasol are even at a point where we're talking about, quote unquote, which star do you side with? Like, that's just not a very Memphis style conversation the way we're used to thinking about the Grizzlies and those two guys. So I just think it's the fact that they let themselves get to a point where, you know, the culture is funky and, you know, where some of that front office stuff has started to get onto the court. And the thing I forgot to mention, speaking of health, like, in the midst of all that, then you get the news that comes out, or the rumor that comes out, I should say, that, you know, they potentially didn't do all the due diligence when they signed Chandler Parsons. And I mean, there's been very little that has come out of Memphis this season that has been encouraging or positive in any way. It's been a rough stretch for them. And that's why I failed them.
All right, Dan Clayton, you picked that one, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Back to me. I am going to go with the Sacramento Kings, who I gave a D- almost solely on coaching. Why is Zach Randolph playing 25 minutes a game? Why is Garrett Temple playing 26 minutes a game? Maybe I can put a little bit of this on the front office too. Why is George Hill even on this team? Why is Zach Randolph even on this team? Why is Vince Carter on this team? It felt like they made those moves like, we need to add vets to our young core to teach them how to play maybe like a year or two too early. But ultimately, I'm even more disappointed in the way that the coaches handled this thing. I think their leader in minutes played this season is De'Aaron Fox at 26.1, tied with Garrett Temple. They are playing – Jaeger's playing 11 guys more than 17 minutes a game. This is just – he's just wasting a quarter of an NBA season when you could be developing intriguing young players like Fox and Scalabissier and Willie Cauley-Stein and helping Buddy Hield, playing all those guys together, giving them time to grow some chemistry together. But instead, you're playing Zach Randolph in crunch time. And plus, it sounds like all of a sudden George Hill's not even happy being there. He had the tweet with the like 50 angry face emojis, and I don't know if we ever got an explanation for that or not. But
I think his explanation was just he was upset with a loss, and he didn't. Oh,
okay.
He wasn't at a
barber shop.
Right, that's a slightly more convincing excuse than I was at a beauty salon. So
yeah, we'll anyway, there's just like the typical Sacramento chaos combined with Jaeger doing what he's doing. I had to give them a D-.
Dan
Clayton. Keep forgetting to pass it off, but I'm going to go to Dan.
No worries. This was the other team I failed for the exact same reasons. This was my other F team. I feel like they don't know what they're doing at a franchise level. Even when they signed Randolph and George Hill, it didn't make sense to me. And Vince Carter, by the way. Like, Vince Carter's getting a lot of minutes for them. I like Vince Carter. I like George Hill. I like Zebo. Just none of those guys make sense for what Sacramento's trying to do. And then you point out, like, Garrett Temple, 26 minutes. Like, he doesn't fit either model. You know what I mean? Like, I get it if you're like, all right, we're going to show these guys how to play. I get it if you're like, okay, we need to play the kids. But Garrett Temple, you know, he's a nice utility journeyman. And not really the guy that you expect to see tied for the minutes per game lead. He doesn't use a ton of possessions because that's the type of player he is. But I this team doesn't really know what they're up to. So for me, this is worse than just being regular bad team bad. Because there are teams that are bad, but they're at least bad in a sense that they know what they're doing, like the Suns and that sort of thing. Sacramento is bad and seems to have very little clue what the plan is to stop being bad or what the plan is to get players playing better. They're just a weird team to me.
I think I'm just going to make my point in one statement. Zach Randolph leads this team in crunch time minutes. Like, that's just on the one hand, it's like no one's averaging 30 minutes per game, so they've gone that 2016-2017 Brooklyn Nets route. At the same time, like, Kenny Atkinson in Brooklyn's always done a nice job blending play between the veterans and the kiddies, and I don't think Dave Yeager's doing a good enough job of that. It seems that he's favoring De'Aaron Fox over George Hill now, which is it's perfectly fine, but he's probably the one veteran that you signed that you – can't necessarily, I don't want to use the word afford to bench, but he's not the one who signed under the guise that, hey, I'm here to just be a full-blown mentor. Like, Zach Randolph knew he was being overpaid. Vince Carter, I think, even came out and said they gave me a lot of money. And George Hill, meanwhile, was probably expecting more money than he got in free agency, especially more guaranteed money because he only has $1 million guarantee in the final year of his deal. And we can talk about he was angry about that loss to Milwaukee because they almost – kind of came back and won it, but he kind of had to be pissed that not only was he benched for the entire fourth quarter, but Dave Jaeger closed with Garrett Temple and Zach Randolph, and he also played Zebo the entire fourth quarter. Zebo's not, if you want someone on the floor, like, who's going to provide value, but also, I guess, be a steadying presence, it's not Zebo anymore. He doesn't provide that on-court value, and it seems like they whiffed on this culture-building front. I was kind of okay with it, like, leading into the year, but it does not seem, despite what George Hill might have said, like, just based off that tweet, it does not seem that he was ready for the role that they expected him to assume. And again, there is no way that Zach Randolph should be the most used player in crunch time for this roster, particularly when Sacramento has so many young bigs.
Yep, totally. I totally agree. Back to you, Dan. Dan
right.
with an F.
So I'm just going to go with let's go with the Houston Rockets. Let's go with a good team because this was kind of depressing for the last two. They've been absolutely sensational, and I'm like very – I'm astounded that James Harden is basically who's – I believe he's leading the league in assists and points per game, which is ridiculous. He's basically doing what he did last season but with better efficiency, and that's while playing most of the year without Chris Paul. And then now when Chris Paul's on the floor, they're just straight destroying opponents. And I'm really interested to see, you know, if they were going up against the Golden State Warriors right now in a seven-game set, yes, the Warriors are the clear favorites. But when you look at kind of their just their personnel, now it looks like they're built to play any style because they can run out super small lineups with P.J. Tucker at the five. Ryan Anderson has been really good defending in one-on-one situations this season. Clint Capella is a little bit switchy up front if you want to go more traditional as well. I think they might have the firepower and the defensive versatility within certain lineups to make it a series against Golden State, and I'm not sure we could say that of anyone else in the league, not even just the Western Conference right now. And, you know, Eric Gordon, with the exception of the past maybe week or two, he's been really good. Luke and Bob Moot shooting threes again, putting the ball on the floor has been fantastic for them defensively. The big question for them, I guess, is, you know, will Chris Paul kind of stay healthy all year? But the other question is how much it matters, but like they have their fifth in points allowed per 100 possessions right now. So this isn't even like his absence has kind of killed their defensive potential. I don't know if this defense is sustainable, but they look like a two-way team with, again, the versatility to kind of stack up against the Warriors more so than anyone else in the NBA right now. And I'll throw it to DC.
Yeah, I love what the Rockets are doing, and in particular the way that they have won games playing so many different styles of basketball. You know, when it's almost counterintuitive, when Chris Paul was out, it felt like they slowed down and played a much more deliberate style, and actually, like on a season standpoint, they're still below average in pace, which is a little weird for a Mike D'Antoni coached team. Then Chris Paul got back, kind of this master of the half court, and they've been trying to speed things up and get him a little bit more involved in this culture of not quite 7 seconds or less, but just, you know, quick motions and one action right after another. So I just think the fact that they've been able to be as good as they've been, they're 18-4. They've played an NBA low 6 games that had any clutch qualifications to them, meaning that, and they're 4-2 in those games. So they're 14-2 in games that were never even close. I mean, that, you know, 14 games that just weren't even close in the end. And that's, you know, that's even more than Golden State, to you gentlemen's posts about points earlier about Golden State falling asleep at times and letting teams hang around. Houston doesn't do that. You know, they seem to be a team on a mission. James Harden, I think, is far and away the MVP front runner. So I have them as an A team. And, you know, you could argue A minus because we still have to get some of the answers on Chris Paul and James Harden, but that's nobody's fault. I think it's really interesting, and I'm particularly encouraged by the fact that they continue to just destroy teams even when one or the other of those two are playing. So that's going to be something that really helps them as the season goes on.
I gave them an A too, just in case that wasn't clear before Andy came in. I know I didn't say it. They get an A.
Yeah, I was going to ask. This is the only team I gave an A plus. I would still pick the Warriors in a series, but the Rockets have been so good that it's gotten to a point where I wouldn't be like stunned if they beat them in a 7-game series. For all of the reasons you guys already mentioned, they can have 48 minutes of Hall of Fame level point guard play. They now have two very switchy combo forwards in Luke Mbamute and PJ Tucker. Clint Capella, is the numbers he's putting up this season are like prime Dwight Howard, maybe even slightly better than prime Dwight Howard. It's just insane if you compare what he's doing this season to some of those early Orlando years from Dwight. And the last thing I'll say is, there was some concern about how the two superstars would fit, Harden and Chris Paul. James Harden while Chris Paul was out, averaged 31 points, 10 assists, 5 rebounds, 2 steals, with a 62 true shooting percentage. Since Chris Paul's return, he's averaging 34 points, 9 assists, 6 rebounds, 2 steals, and has a 67 true shooting percentage. So it's safe to say that at least offensively, that combo is working very, very well. That's an A-plus team for me. And I think we are back to Dan Clayton.
Let's do Utah. Let's go for it. Let's do Utah.
Can I just interject and say I was waiting for one? I was like, how long are they? I wasn't going to pick them. I was like, how long are one of these Jazz aficionados going to wait before they throw Utah into this? I'm impressed.
Yeah, let's do the team I cover primarily at Salt City Hoops, and a team I've covered, by the way, since 2003, when I started writing for a little free take one Spanish language newspaper in the valley there. The Jazz are, they're figuring out a way to do it once again. They've got the fifth best net rating in the NBA right now, behind only the Warriors, Rockets, Raptors, and Celtics. Their recent 7-1 stretch is a little bit ridiculous when you consider that pretty much all of it was without Rudy Gobert. They still haven't had Dante Exum at all this season. Rodney Hood has been in and out. So it's really impressive what they're doing. I gave them a B+ because I think, much like, again, I'm going to go with another metaphor. This is another metaphorical grade. It's kind of like that paper that, like, you do all the things that the teacher asks you to do, but you forgot to answer one key question. Like, I still think that there are just some big looming questions about Gobert and Favors together. And then the other thing that really needs solving and answering that should be concerning for the Jazz and their fans, you know, a quarter way into the season, is the Ricky Rubio thing. You know, shooting wise, I'm not as worried, because nobody expected him to be, you know, a super consistent lights out shooter. He started really hot, then he had a terrible stretch of like 8 games where it seems like he couldn't find the basket. Since then, he's kind of been, you know, on and off from a shooting perspective. But the really puzzling thing is that defensively he hasn't had much of an impact. And then because of the shooting thing, the Jazz have had to take him out of the pick and roll and give more pick and roll possessions to guys like Joe Ingles and Donovan Mitchell and Raul Neto. And the result of all that is that he's also not in a position where he's able to facilitate the way we're used to. And so he's having a career low year from an assist perspective. So really the two things that we associate with Ricky Rubio historically, you know, defense and just that creative flair for facilitation, are things that the Jazz aren't really getting from him. And I'm kind of one of those people who, when it's, you know, a veteran proven guy, I think he'll probably sort it out to some degree or another. But until he answers that, and I think if he answers that, it makes some of the spacing questions with Gobert and Favors a little easier to figure out. Because of that, I couldn't go higher than a B+. But I mean, Donovan Mitchell playing far beyond anybody's wildest expectations. I think the Jazz have a lot of reasons to be excited and a few outstanding questions they still need to answer.
I also went with a B+ on the Jazz. I was real tempted to give them an A because of this recent stretch. Since November 22nd, they have the best net rating in the NBA. They're outscoring opponents by 25.8 points per 100 possessions. They also have the best offense, scoring 123.4, and they have the third best defense, allowing 97.5. Now, obviously, those numbers in such a small sample are skewed by the 47-point blasting that they gave to the Washington Wizards, but long story short, they have been absurd over the last couple weeks. One of the most encouraging things to me is how well Alec Burks has played. This is not just the best year of his career so far, it's like he's an entirely different player. Just so much more under control, so much more aware on defense. He's just been excellent this season. Dan mentioned Donovan Mitchell, who I had my reservations about, especially after the first 5 games when there was some evidence that he might just be a chucker. He was putting up tons of shots. Yeah, he was putting up so many shots and just not hitting anything. But he has been absurd of late as well. Really, during Gobert's absence, was absolutely Utah's best player. So they've got a lot of good things going. But I would echo what Dan said too about there are still some lingering concerns. The Gobert Favors lineup, which has been, I mean, there's been a lot of talk about it over the last few years, but it's been pretty good. It simply has not this season. They are, when those two are on the floor together, Utah's minus 25 in 243 minutes, which is about, and then they're plus 144 in the other 914 minutes. If you add Rubio to the mix, so it's a three-man lineup now, Favors, Gobert, Rubio is minus 49 in 206 minutes. And I think it's obvious to see why. You can't play three non-shooters together. And one encouraging thing, just in the last couple games, Snyder is still starting Favors and Gobert together, but he's taking Favors out 3 minutes into the game and going with a more spaced lineup and then just staggering those two, making Favors more of a backup center than a starting four. So I think that will help moving forward. But just there are still some rotational things. Before this hot stretch, they were one of the worst offenses in the league. So there's some worry that maybe that'll come back, although I'm not super worried about that. But that's just the reason I wasn't able to go with the A.
I did what you couldn't, and I went with the A.
There you go.
They've battled injuries, and can we remember that they lost two of their probably three best players or four best players from last season in Gordon Hayward and George Hill? And we're talking about Ricky Rubio being up and down, and the fact that they're still just in the middle of the playoff picture. Donovan Mitchell has been spectacular. Like I didn't know much about him when he was leading into Summer League. I thought the trade they made was fine. It seemed it was more about the Nuggets when they made that acquisition because they decided to add their 15th and 16th jillionth power forward during that deal. But I don't know. Utah's bench has been the best thing to watch for me, and they've been better collectively than the starters for most of this year. And I think one of my favorite lineups, which hasn't really been available to Quinn Snyder on command just because of like the different health issues, is when he just throws out what amounts to that all bench unit of Burks, Hood, Neto, Cephalosha, and Udo. They've played 36 minutes this year, and they're shooting 14 of 28 from three, 50%, 53.8% from the field overall. They're absolutely destroying opponents. 135 points per 100 possessions they're scoring, allowing only 94, good for a net rating of 41. Like, that's just absolute absurdity. And Andy pointed to Alec Burks playing a little better. Like, that's really big time. And even Rodney Hood kind of being more aggressive, taking some better shots. He was, you know, before his latest injury, he was averaging over 20 points per game over a certain stretch and shooting the lights out. They're so deep, and I think that's really going to help them, because I think it's fine. Ultimately, when you look at their starting unit, or what's going to end up being their starting unit, even if you kind of want to fudge the combinations a bit to account for Quinn Snyder kind of Thon McCurring Derek Favors at this point and just yanking him after 2 or 3 minutes, it's fine to have that defensive identity within the starting unit and a full-blown offensive identity off the bench. Like, that stuff is valuable, and I just continue to be impressed with different people on their roster. I expect every wide open Joe Ingles shot to go in. Tabo Cephalosha was one of the best pickups of the offseason. Even Jonas Jerebko has done some stuff in small bursts. I'm still a Neto fan. I still believe in him, so I think we can pencil them in as a playoff lock, I would say, because I know they haven't really faced any top tier defenses during this latest stretch. But if you're going to be able to keep your head above water when Rudy Gobert, who leading into this year certainly profiled as a top 20 player, and you're going to be able to remove him from the equation, and then you really don't have a top 30 or top 40 or maybe even necessarily top 50 player remaining in your rotation, that body of work is just absolutely fantastic. And I think that Quinn Snyder, if they keep this up or come close and maybe they get like the 6th seed in the West or just avoid getting the 8th seed, he might get some residual coach of the year love.
He should. I think people should be talking about him already. And I get why everybody's talking about Popovich and D'Antoni and Brad Stevens, but I don't think anybody expected Utah to play the way they have over the last 2 weeks at any point in the season.
Yeah, and they've already had their longest winning streak in the last two seasons. They didn't have a winning streak this long at all last season with Gordon Hayward, with George Hill, with Rudy Gobert turning in an all-NBA performance. So, you know, it is pretty impressive what they're doing right now. And weirdly enough, you know, I looked today because I expected to find that, you know, the defenses that they've had this recent explosion against are, you know, are toward the bottom of the league, and some are. But the average ranking of the teams that they've played during the six-game win streak is actually 18. So it's really close to average, which might be an indication that some of this stuff might hold up to some degree, even as they start facing some higher-ranked defenses. We shall see.
That's a good point. Back to me, and with apologies to the remaining fan bases, we might have to be a little bit swifter through these last five. Believe it or not, we are already at about an hour and 20 minutes. So I am going to, I'm going to go to the Los Angeles Clippers. So I think it would be not super difficult to give them a D or an F. Doc Rivers, I think, is very much on the hot seat. Their record is not good, obviously, but I'm going to give them a C just because I can't really fault them for losing most of their starting lineup. Blake Griffin, Patrick Beverley, Danilo Gallinari, even reserve Milos Teodosic went down in like the first game of the season. So I am going to chalk their rough play up to injuries and say, given the circumstances, they've been okay. Dan Clayton, what say you about the Clippers?
Yeah, I did the same thing. I gave them a C minus because I just, if there's a team that I could argue just giving them an incomplete because it seems like the Clippers curse has manifested itself once again. And you know, right from the start, it was Milos and then it was Patrick Beverley, who is pretty important to what they do and even more important with no Milos. So now you're taking Austin Rivers and you're making him the provisional point guard. And then it was Blake. Like, I just don't think that they're a team that we can get a read on or judge too harshly one way or another. It's a bummer. I think they were a bubble playoff team to begin with, but obviously I think this takes them almost completely out of the conversation, and I think they know that, which is why there are DJ rumors out. You know, obviously they're starting to realize that they may have seen the best that this collective group can do.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm basically in lockstep with you guys. I gave them a C. I was prepared to go lower because I feel like they should have already contacted the Wizards and offered to take on Jan Mahinmi in exchange for Kelly Oubre and a lottery-protected first-round pick in 2019 and just send them Jordan and Lou Williams, and you could take back Jason Smith as well. That's the trade that, for them, they need to kind of start looking at a rebuild, and those are the types of moves they should be targeting. The one thing that's weird, if they knew how to defend three-pointers, and this comes back to basically their lack of perimeter talent. Like, Danilo Gallinari was their most switchable defender before he went out. They're really good at coaxing teams into mid-range jumpers. They don't allow a lot of looks at the rim. They don't allow especially high number of three-pointers. They're just not good at defending three-pointers too much, and that accounts for why they've had the league's worst defense over their 4-14 stretch recently. So I think Doc Rivers is on the hot seat more situationally than anything. It's time to rebuild, and if we come back at the half season mark and they haven't committed to a tank or a rebuild, their grade's going to be lower because now the signs are on the wall. DJ has an agent. He's going to be 30 in July and enter free agency. It's time to move on, and now the onus is on the Clippers to actually finally move on.
I like how you just casually dropped this trade idea like it was just popping into your mind, and it has like seven pieces, and like you've already negotiated the pick protection.
So like it's,
that was great.
Yeah, I mean,
Dan's trades are always very specific.
Well, look, I know I was all over the place with it, but the Clippers get Mahinmi, Jason Smith, Kelly Oubre, and a 2019 lottery protected first, and then the Wizards get DeAndre Jordan and Lou Williams. You move Marcin Gortat to the bench. I think that's a winnable deal for both teams, and all of a sudden the Clippers kind of have these assets where they look and say, oh, we have Kelly Oubre, we have an extra first-round pick in 2019 when we owe one to the Celtics. Do we still try and win now with Blake? Do we sell off Beverley and Danilo Gallinari and begin a rebuild because we finally have young players? That just seems like a more palatable avenue for them than where they're at right now.
You were actually the opposite of all over the place.
Oh, was I? I remember listing them out of order, which is like, because it popped into my head like.
No, it was very specific.
I believe
it's your pick,
I'm going to go to the Portland Trailblazers. I gave them a B.
Good.
Yeah, I gave them a B because I wanted to give them a higher grade, maybe even a B+, but the offense is just, like, it has not been good. They're 21st in points scored per 100 possessions, but, like, me oh my, the defense. They're tied for third, basically, with Oklahoma City in points allowed per 100 possessions, and they've just been fantastic at goading teams into these mid-range shots. They have, when you just look at the percentage of shots allowed at the rim and from the three-point line. Like, they have one of the best shot profiles defensively in the league. I think it's like top five or top seven. And this is something I looked up before we started. If you look at, as of right now, the average team is letting up 64.1% shooting at the rim. And Jozef Nurkić, relative to that league average among over 200 players, has saved more value at the rim than anyone not named Kristaps Porzingis. So it's just like, he's been very good. I'm interested to see what he's going to get in restricted free agency. While the offense hasn't been great overall, Damian Lillard has been absolute money in the clutch. He just seems to get to the free throw line at will there. Al-Farouq Aminu, when he's healthy, really just provides a different dynamic to this team. I still really want to believe that Evan Turner can help them if they run McCollum and Lillard off the ball more, but that's kind of iffy territory. I'm not sure what to make of their future immediately because they don't have a lot of cap flexibility or these really desirable trade assets. But looking at what they've done right now, I think you could even say that Terry Stotts is one of the five or six candidates for coach of the year right now, only because the Blazers' defense has been impeccable. And if offense is your problem when you have Lillard or McCollum, I think it's fair to believe that you'll eventually turn a corner.
Dan Clayton, where do you have the Blazers?
Yeah, it's funny. When I first started doing this last night, I actually had the Blazers a little bit higher and then talked myself back to exactly Dan's grade, a B. I think I had assumed they were kind of a playoff lock already, and really they're kind of playing 500-ish ball over the last 10 or 12 games. They were 6-4, and now they're 13-10. So a little bit more pedestrian than memory had served. I like the fact that they are 13-10, despite the fact that the offense hasn't been clicking, because I think that that's a new component of their identity for me. That's interesting, and the fact that they're doing it without a real traditional shot blocker. I mean, you're right that Nurk has been impressive defensively for them and probably better than a lot of people expected, but he's still not like a paint patroller in the traditional sense. And so, that's interesting. They're also only San Antonio and Memphis have better clutch defenses in the West. And so again, if we think about kind of the Portland narrative of Dame time and that they win close games by just coming up with shots, the fact that they're doing so much of what they're doing, even in close games on the defensive end, is something that I like, because I think eventually Dame will kind of get back on track. I don't think he's been playing his best basketball, and I think once he does, they've stumbled on some things that I think can make them just a stronger team overall. But, they're basically now looking like they're going to be a 6-8 seed, and that's where we would have pegged them going into the season. So it's hard to give them much better than a B on the macro, even though my kind of hip shot, my shot from the hip grade was a little higher. I think it's fair to say that they're not really doing much differently in terms of results. It's just the process that's kind of unique for Portland Blazers basketball.
I went B plus for the Blazers. They are currently eighth in the league in net rating, outscoring opponents by 2.6 points per 100 possessions. You guys both mentioned the defense, which is a completely new thing for them. And offensively, yeah, they're not as good as they've traditionally been in recent years. But if you look at that roster, there's really not much in terms of offensive weapons beyond Lillard and McCollum. So just being passable and having that good of a defense, like Dan said, this is sort of a new avenue to success for them, and that's impressed me. So I went with the B+. And we are back to Mr. Clayton on the next pick.
All right. Well, since I know we're trying to hustle, I'll go with the Suns next. I think we only have bad teams left, really. So
yeah,
the Suns for me are a D team. And again, I didn't have them down at the F category with a couple of other teams that I just think are a little more rudderless, because the Suns, at least expected to be bad, planned on being bad, obviously have to fire their coach just three games into the season because the effort level was so poor, is not ideal. But I think they're starting to get, I've been a Devin Booker doubter, just because I think he has kind of been empty calories in the past. He scores a lot, but his efficiency has never been great. And you know, obviously defensively, he's never been, not just defensively, historically, he didn't rebound a lot for his size and for his position, and he didn't create a lot for how much he has the ball. This year, I think he's doing a couple of those things better. He's still not defending well. In fact, you know, the video the other day of their defensive effort was pretty hysterical. Now finally starting to do that 20 plus scoring on a respectable efficiency level. I think he's at like 560 on true shooting percentage. And, you know, he's like a 24-4 guy in terms of points, rebounds, and assists. And I just think that's where he needs to be to be considered more than just a big numbers on a bad team guy. I think he's starting to look like someone who has the beginnings of, you know, having a clue to be a winning player in the NBA. And because of that, I think they're just further along than the teams I gave an F. So a D, because you just have to try harder than that, no matter where you're at in the cycle. But, you know, with some good things to look at going forward.
I went C minus for the Suns. Like Dan said, I think this is kind of where we expected them to be. And I think I give them a little bit of boost because I too am starting to get comfortable in the Devin Booker bandwagon. He's been spectacular this season, at least offensively. The center rotation has been an annoyance of mine all season and really for the last couple seasons. The Eric Bledsoe stuff was not ideal, but again, this is not much worse than I would have expected. So I went C minus.
I'm going to give him a C minus, but can I give Jay Triano like a B plus just because he's unleashed Dragan Bender, which I've been a fan of. Since Triano took over, Bender has the fifth most minutes on the team. The Suns' current lineup, is Booker, Tyson Chandler, Marquise Chris, Mike James, and TJ Warren. They're a net plus per 100 possessions under Triano, outscoring opponents by 5.2 points per 100 possessions with a really good defense and a so-so offense. I'm with everything you guys said on Devin Booker. Still just, he makes the occasional good reads on pick and roll, but he's not there defensively. I think it's a good sign that he's increased his passing and some of his volume, and yet his efficiency has not plunged. It's either held steady or improved, and that's always a good sign for a young player. I've been very impressed with TJ Warren. Did not like his extension. Still wish he could shoot threes, which he really can't. Josh Jackson has been disappointing. Moving forward, I think I'd like them to see, before we revisit this at the half-season mark, they need to work on Chris's face-up game and really not just give him the green light, but like encourage him to be aggressive somehow, because it's a mess, and he needs to be able to put the ball on the floor if he's going to ever be a small ball five or succeed at the four. I want to continue to see more of Bender, and the other thing would be you have to get Josh Jackson to be more aggressive on the offensive end somehow as well, to see if he can develop into this plus player there so that you can experiment more with your most versatile defensive combinations.
All right, I am going to take us to the Dallas Mavericks. In recent episodes, Dan and I have talked about this a couple times, I think, but over the last 20 regular seasons, they've basically been the second best team in the league, if we just look at regular season, by a bunch of different metrics. The only team that's really been more successful than them is the Spurs. So just from that standpoint, it's weird to see a Mavericks team that could very well be like one of the worst three teams in the league. I expected them to be bad this season. I don't know if I expected them to be like bottom three in the NBA or bottom four or five, whatever you want to say. There were still some pieces that were intriguing. Some of those pieces have played better the last couple of games, but just generally, they, like I said a couple times now, they're one of the very worst teams in the NBA. Dennis Smith is a lot of typical rookie things, but they're just kind of magnified with him. He's been wildly, wildly inefficient. Dirk Nowitzki is clearly at the end of his ridiculous career. So this is another team I went with a C minus, just because I don't think they're that much worse than I expected, but are still a little bit worse. Dan Clayton, what say you on the Mavs?
Yeah, I did a C for basically the same reasons. This is what we expect to see out of them. It would have been nice to have the Nerlens Noel situation reach a different end so that they could really go into kind of a full season with him kind of committed and part of the program, and knowing that going forward he's going to be you know, someone that they could incorporate. But the fact that that the negotiations were as contentious as they were and then ended with him taking the QO, obviously there's just not the same level of buy-in there. And that really impacts them because they just don't have that many starting quality bigs. And obviously one of those starting quality bigs is like 90 years old in Dirk. So that's going to hurt them. They've always been a team, or for the last several years anyway, they've been a team with a lot of guard depth. It seems like they have a monopoly on like, you know, combo guard types. And they're still getting, you know, they're still getting good play out of a lot of guys like JJ Barea, and on any given night, Devin Harris plays well and stuff like that. But really, I just don't think they have the big man depth to do much more than what they've done. And that's why I parked them right there.
I actually gave them a C also, but I guess I move away from what both of you have said because they need to be worse. Like, they're one of the teams where I don't think they're as bad as their record suggests. And over their last 10, you could see that. They're 5-5 with a top 9 point differential per 100 possessions. Their starting lineup is one of the three worst in the leagues in terms of point differential per 100 possessions, which is a good start. And they've given the keys to Dennis Smith Jr. But, like, it's time to start shopping Wesley Matthews, see what you can get. Is any team going to want J.J. Barrera, who's been just a little bit too good? You need to fire up the tank here. And if you're going to go against these really aggressive rock bottomers like the Phoenix Suns or the Sacramento Kings, the Atlanta Hawks, and the Chicago Bulls, you need to find a way to kind of get worse. I've been sometimes impressed by their defense. The whole did not play tummy ache from eating too many hot dogs with Nerlens Noel is not a situation I saw kind of manifesting itself. They're in a very weird spot, but I would kind of like to see them steer in to this tank, because even with their injuries out west, they're not going to be a playoff team, and it would really behoove them to kind of clear off some cap space in advance of this summer when a lot of teams aren't going to have a ton of cap room, and also just to ensure that they get those top five or even closer to top three lottery odds so that you move forward with Dennis Smith Jr. and that other high-end prospect, because they don't really have that right now. You know, Dorian Finney-Smith, maybe he's injured, but aside from Dennis Smith, what's the future of this team? It's not Dirk. Are people that high on Harrison Barnes, who still struggles to provide any profound value despite being a pretty good one-on-one scorer and, you know, nifty defender at points? I don't know that they have that second building block, so you want to tank to ensure that you get it. If neither of you have anything to add on them, though, that would leave us with the last team, is the Los Angeles Lakers, who I gave a B almost entirely because I've been absolutely, positively, without question, shocked by their defense. Even though it's kind of slipped in recent weeks, they're eighth in points allowed per 100 possessions. If you would have told me that they're one of the best teams at playing defense after live rebounds, after opponent misses, according to Clean the Glass, I never would have just believed it. They're doing a good job getting back in transition. They're trying really hard. Kentavious Caldwell-Pope has been erratic on the offensive end, but he's really given them A-plus efforts on that side of the ball. Julius Randle has been verging on spectacular when teams attack him in isolation. It seems kind of like they're doing the Ryan Anderson thing in Houston. They're going to go at Randle because he's supposed to be bad, but he's just surviving on his own. I am very much entertained by people who thought that the Kyle Kuzma, Brandon Ingram discussion was actually one worth having. Brandon Ingram is so much more engaged on the defensive end, switches a ton, and on offense, while he's not the most efficient player, and I'm curious to see if you two agree, it just seems like he gets to his spots, and that once he kind of nails down his timing a little bit more or looks a little bit more comfortable getting off his shots, like, he's going to be fantastic, because to be able to just get through the lane and knife through traffic or be able to pull up and rise over players, like, that's a huge deal to me. And the final thought would be Lonzo Ball has been surprisingly pretty good on defense. He gets defensive rebounds, it seems like by design, for the Lakers, but he's done a nice job kind of poking away the ball from behind plays and getting some blocks as well. So this team has surprised me there, and I don't think they're going to hover too close to the Western Conference playoff picture this season. Like, right now they're 3.5 games out, and they've lost five in a row, so they're fading off, and they'll be a team that should probably finish with one of the three worst records in the Western Conference if we expect the Grizzlies to get better at all. But just looking at their defense, I had to give them a B plus thus far, and while they're even slotting, I might have considered going higher if they were still in the top five. I'm very interested to see where they end up at the midseason mark, and I'll throw it to Dan.
Yeah, so I gave them a C plus, although I don't think, you know, our macro assessments are that far apart. The C mostly because, you know, again, they're doing what I expected them to do. The plus is the fact that, you know, we complained earlier about Sacramento not knowing what they're doing, not knowing what the plan is. I like the fact that in LA, they have stayed true to the approach. And, you know, look, I see all the same lineup data and on-court data about Lonzo Ball, and I know that it's kind of become a big joke around the NBA, but, like, that's what you do when you're at the Lakers' point of the process. You know what I mean? You throw in minutes, you get data, you find out what he can and can't do, and then you move forward from there. Kuzma's been great, but I agree with you. I mean, Ingram is the one who, you know, he suddenly looks like a grown-up. He suddenly looks like a guy who... You mentioned he can get to his spots, Dan. I think the impressive thing is now he knows where those spots are, because I think too much when I watched them last season, he just kind of floated or took what the defense gave him, and now he's just a lot more assertive. He still makes bad decisions at times on both sides of the ball, but I think he's starting to look like someone who you know, could turn into a building block player for them, a building block type player for them. And mostly, like I say, I'm just impressed that they know what they want to be identity-wise. Walton is a good coach, and I think that's a big part of the reason why the defensive numbers look solid early on. They don't have any really big quality wins, which is why, you know, I think some of that might be a little paper tiger-ish. but ultimately, I think they've done what they were supposed to do, and they've done what's the smart thing to do given where they're at and the makeup of their roster, and to your point, they'll get another high pick to add to that. I'm not sure it'll be quite you know, it's not going to be a top five pick probably. There are too many just blatantly bad teams and teams trying to be bad and that sort of thing, but I think the Lakers understand the process and they're in that process, and they have two and maybe three really good players to start with.
It would be nice if they I would be so on board with their tank if they actually own their own pick too, that it has to go to Boston or Philly this year. I'm curious to see, Dan, do you think it's going to end up? It's top seven. I think it's like the protection's weird.
It's
top one protected and then 6-30 protected. I think I'm going to say it ends up with Philly. I don't think they're going to finish, you know, 2, 3, 4 or 5. I think they might even wind up in that 6th or 7th worst record spot. So I think it ends up going to Philly. That's my prediction.
Yeah, and that's actually right where 538 is projecting them as well. You know, a team that's going to finish right around the Mavs, ahead of the Suns and Kings, but then obviously there are some bad teams in the East as well, and you know, mostly the Hawks and Bulls, because the Nets don't have a motivation to be bad as the season ends. So yeah, I mean, that's probably accurate. They'll probably be maybe a 5, but more likely a 6 or 7, which means the pick moves.
I've got them in a C plus as well, and it's just kind of a merger of both of your answers. I never would have expected the defense to be this good. I am encouraged by the way that Brandon Ingram has played. And although Lonzo Ball has some historically bad shooting numbers, pretty much every other aspect of the game you can point to and say he's been pretty dang good for a rookie. So I think there's a lot to like with the Lakers, but of course they are still an objectively bad team with the wins and losses. So I went C plus, and that wraps us up. We incredibly got through all 15 teams tonight. If you want to yell at us on Twitter, all you hate listeners out there, or you hate tweeters, you can find Dan Clayton on Twitter at Dan Clayton, just how it sounds, except for you got to replace the O in Clayton with a 0. And again, Dan
Clayton find, 0N.
Yeah, there you go. You can find his work on Salt City Hoops, B-Ball Breakdown, FanRag Sports. And he mentioned this briefly at some point in the show, but Dan was actually you were the Spanish radio announcer for the Jazz too, right?
Yeah. Mostly color commentary, some play by play for Spanish radio for the last 4 years I lived in Utah.
So this guy has a pretty unique, he has a unique background with basketball that I don't think a lot of NBA Twitter does. So he is a very, very good follow. And as you heard on the podcast, he's, you know, he's one of the smartest basketball guys we have on NBA Twitter. You can, yes, sir. You can follow Dan on Twitter as well. He's at Dan Favale, F-A-V-A-L-E. I'm at Andrew D. Bailey. The show's at Harvard Knox. NBA Math is at NBA underscore math. And of course, as always, we would love it if you guys would review the show, rate the show, tell your friends to subscribe. We appreciate all of that. And as always, we leave you with the shout outs, plural now, to Beno Udrih and Kyle Anderson.